Saram, dear listeners, offering my loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is a show in which we take up the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse. We study it in detail. I give you a brief meaning of each of those verses, and then we discuss the import of each of these beautiful words which have come directly from the Lord Himself. And this is the 10th episode, and I'm very, very grateful to be having the company of all of you in this effort of understanding better the Bhagavad Gita, which we so often turn to when we are trying to understand concepts that Swami has taught us. The Vedantic concepts are said to be explained more clearly in the Bhagavad Gita, and that is why some of the concepts which appear contrarian to each other when we read the Upanishads as individual works, some of them get evened out in this, and a very beautiful comprehensive manual as to how to lead life spiritually, which is actually the right way to lead life. Though I'm saying that leading life spiritually, this is how life is meant to be led, and that's what the Bhagavad Gita teaches us, and we are ever so grateful to be able to do this on Radio Sai with all of you for company, and with, of course, Swami's words to guide us, because as you would have been noticing, that I often go back to the Gita Vahini, the book that Swami has himself written about the Bhagavad Gita, because even though the Bhagavad Gita is a simplification of the Upanishads, even that is not as simple to us, and so we should be grateful that we have a work like the Gita Vahini to turn to. Apart from that, of course, there are many, many scholars who have written about it, who, this is a text which has caught the attention of scholars over many, many decades and centuries, and that vast knowledge is also available for us to go back into and try to understand these verses. As I said, this is the 10th episode and we are still in the second chapter, and in fact it's today that we are going to begin the real Bhagavad Gita in that sense. One of the most classic commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, as I said, many, many scholars have written about it, but one work which really stands above much of them is the commentary or Bhashyam written by Adi Shankara. And Adi Shankara begins his commentary from the verse that we're going to start today, which is the 10th verse of the second chapter. So in that sense, he found it right to begin his commentary from here, because he feels the true Bhagavad Gita, or the supreme song sung by the Lord himself, begins actually from this point. So in that sense, yes, it has taken us 9 episodes to come to this, but as we've been mentioning, discussing past few episodes, all of that discussion also is very, very important, because the Bhagavad Gita as a work is very profound, but what makes it important to us is that we should be able to place it in context, and we should be able to understand how it is relevant to us as we lead our lives today. And the first chapter and the first few verses of the second chapter help us do this, and that's why it's very much important to go through them too, and that's why Vedavyasa in all his wisdom has included them as part of Bhagavad Gita. So we started with all of that. But before we go to that 10th verse of the second chapter and thereafter where Krishna speaks, let me give you a brief summary of what we discussed last time around. The last episode we discussed verses from verse number 5 to verse number 9 of the second chapter. And this was after Krishna gave a brief insight into his opinion of whatever Arjuna had said so far. Apparently harsh words, he told that he does not agree with the conclusions that Arjuna had come to. And in response to that, Arjuna further clarifies why he is feeling the way he is feeling, and that those are the verses that come from 5 to 9. And Arjuna hints that, you know, even if they were to win the battle, all that is got through that victory, be it comforts, be it the wealth or the sovereignty that is gained, he says that all of that will be smeared or tainted with the blood of all these people. And Arjuna says that he is not able to choose, because losing will lead to sorrow, but winning also is going to be leading to sorrow, because because of this very reason that Arjuna said. So when two choices are in front of you and both seem to be bleak, both seem to be leading to sorrow, how does one choose? And that's the question Arjuna asks Krishna. He says, how do I make a choice? And that is a very, very important question that Arjuna raises. And the option Arjuna is suggesting at this point is, don't make a choice at all. Run away from the point of making a choice. And he is basically giving or hinting at the idea of sannyasi. And as we said, he was suggesting a life of beggary. And what he means by that is to become a mendicant, to become a sannyasi. Effectively running away from making the choice when both choices seem to be leading to a sorrow, but slightly different kind of sorrow, but both are sorrows and you are having to choose between the two. And we also saw how this defines two important concepts the Gita is going to teach about, this particular query that Arjuna is raising. One, the science of choice making itself, and the other is sannyasa or giving up action altogether a good option, right? So these are the two questions among the many other concepts discussed in the Bhagavad Gita, which are very important, which Krishna will be speaking about. And of course, the other one is what we had discussed in the previous episode, where Swami had explained, where Arjuna asks, how am I supposed to act? Not only what am I supposed to do, but he is also asking how. So these three things form three important concepts Krishna will explain. And after all this, Arjuna goes on to diagnose his problem himself. He knows that what he is saying is not right. So Arjuna goes on to explain in a very beautiful phrase. He says, Karpanya dosha upahata swabhavaha. He says, my discrimination or my idea of right and wrong, dharma and adharma, is being clouded by Karpanya dosha. And it's a very beautiful verse, as I said, because Karpanya means sympathy or compassion, but it also means miserliness. And the explanation that we discussed last time is that each one of us is capable of loving the entire humanity equally, right? That is the ability that is given to us, because we are essentially the spark of divinity, spark of Swami, and we've seen Swami having that ability to love everybody as his own. We also have that ability, but in our attachment, we mark out a few people as belonging to us, and we show that love, compassion, and sympathy only to those people. Only their pain affects us, only their joy gives us joy. Right? So when we are capable of much more, we are displaying much less. And that is a sign of miserliness, when you have much to spend, but you spend less. So Karpanya dosha is the fault that comes because of this kind of miserliness, when you're able to love everybody as your own, but you choose some to be your own and love only them. So Arjuna says that this Karpanya dosha is blinding me, O Krishna. So he admits his flaw himself. And mentioning this, he says, Krishna, accept me as your Sishya, as your disciple. And we also discussed how being a Sishya is quite different from being someone who just takes instructions from the other, or being a dasa, or being a slave. Arjuna says that if you tell me to fight, in the next verse he explains this very beautifully. He says, Krishna, if you tell me to fight, I will fight, and if I fight, I will win. But I'm not convinced that I'm supposed to fight. And because I'm not convinced, this sorrow will not die with me obeying you. The sorrow is going to keep pouncing on me over and over again. So Arjuna tells Krishna, you tell me what to do, and you also explain to me why that is the right thing to do. And that is why Arjuna becomes a Sishya and not merely somebody who takes instructions from Krishna. In saying so, Arjuna again sits back on his seat and refuses to fight. And that is the final verse that we went through, where Sanjaya explains the last scene of Arjuna dropping down to his seat to Dhritarashtra. So that's verse 9 of chapter 2. And I think with this we will move to the verse 10 of chapter 2. As I said, this point marks a very important point in the Bhagavad Gita, because from here the true philosophical content of the Bhagavad Gita begins. And it begins with, again, Sanjaya conveying to Dhritarashtra a further description of the site, but he conveys something which is very, very subtle and very important, but I'll explain that after playing for you the verse as rendered by Brother Shyam, who is an alumnus of our university, who has very beautifully rendered all of these verses. So I'm going to play it in his voice. After that, I'll give you a brief meaning and then we'll discuss about it.
Tamuvacharishikeshah prahasanniva bharat senayorubhayor madhye vishidantamidam vachah.
To him who was despondent in the midst of two armies, Krishna, as if smiling, O Bharata, spoke these words. Going by our tradition, actually, I should have put the verse which follows this also with this, because it doesn't complete the sentence in that sense. But there are a few things which Sanjaya makes an observation of, which is important for us to keep in mind. And also, hereafter starts some of the very, very powerful verses of the Bhagavad Gita. To give you a brief about the second chapter or the verses that are going to follow from this point onwards, yes, it is called Sankhya Yoga, the entire chapter, but in many ways, the second chapter is like an entire summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita. Concept-wise, it speaks of all the various things that will be explained in detail in the forthcoming chapters. So in that sense, the second chapter is a summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita, but also it gives some of the most powerful and profound philosophies up front, and it's important to understand the concept of that, and that is why this verse is important, and I'm going to be taking a little more time speaking about the context of the Bhagavad Gita, the context of the philosophy that follows from this point. The reason why this particular verse is very beautiful is, as I said, it sets the context for the teaching of the Gita. And first and foremost, Sanjaya tells Dhritarashtra, he says, Tamuvacha Rishikesha Prahasanniva Bharata. He says Krishna smiled as he spoke. Why should Krishna smile? Is he a sadist? Because Arjuna is crying here. Arjuna is despondent here. Just some time back, Sanjaya described Arjuna as having Ashrupurna Akulekshanam, depressed eyes that were brimming with tears. He said that his sorrow is genuine. He is literally tearing up. And here Krishna is smiling. And why is Krishna smiling at Arjuna's plight? And describing this particular situation, Swami writes in the Gita Vahini, he says, till now, Arjuna spoke from the viewpoint of delusion. All his argument came from egotism. When he started his entire argument, the first thing that he said, as we saw a few episodes back, is, Drishtva imam swajanam Krishna. That's what he says. He says, when I see my people standing here, Krishna, that is the point where all of Arjuna's vishada or despondency begins. It is all coming from the viewpoint of egotism and attachment. And egotism is delusion, right? The feeling that these people alone belong to me is the delusion. Of course, it will be explained in the verses that will follow. But Arjuna's arguments and Arjuna's sorrow, all of that is coming from the viewpoint of delusion. And Swami says, Krishna's viewpoint was prema or love. Yes, Krishna spoke harsh words just now. Yes, Krishna is smiling now even as Arjuna is crying, but it is not out of apathy, but it is out of love. Then why is Krishna smiling? If these words are out of love, if whatever Krishna is explaining is out of his love, why is Krishna smiling when Arjuna is crying? You know, many people come in contact with Swami for various reasons. There are many who have come for education alone. Many, many students that I've met who had finished their engineering, they were just looking out for some college which will give them an MBA degree. They came across an application form for our university. They signed up and they landed up as students here. For them, Swami was their chancellor. There are many, many teachers who came here purely to, in search of a good career. Right, there's one of our lecturers who still teaches in our university, Professor Gangadhar Shastri. I'm sure you'd have heard him in the other programs. He was saying that he came to the university like that. He was in a job somewhere outside when he was looking for better prospects, and he found that this was a new university which was coming up. So he applied here, he got here, he came for the interview, got selected. So the first interaction that he had with Swami was like this. It was very, very weird for us when we look back now, because he interacted with Swami just like how a new recruit would interact with his boss. Swami comes up to him and Swami asks, "So when did you come?" And he very formally gets up and he replies, "I came yesterday, sir." And then Swami smiled, and you know, he had a mischievous smile on his face. And Swami asked, "How are you, sir?" And very, very courteously, Professor Gangadhar Shastri replied, "I'm fine, thank you, sir. How about you?" Imagine asking all this to Swami. The thing is, this was how his first interaction with Swami started. More than 30 years later, he's still here. He still continues to teach our university students. But today, for him, Swami is Swami, right? Swami is not, when I say Swami is Swami, I mean Swami has become his Lord. Swami is no more his boss. Swami is no more somebody who gave him a job. So in all of our lives, the point I'm trying to make is we come to Swami for different things. You know, there are many, many people cases of people who come as drivers for their bosses who are coming for the first darshan. There are, as I said, students who come like that. There are doctors who came purely in search of professional satisfaction. Similarly, Arjuna got to know Krishna as a cousin brother, right? His mother Kunti's brother is Vasudeva, who is Krishna's father. So Arjuna comes to know Krishna as his own cousin brother. But then later he slowly develops a certain kind of respect for him, right? Because he found that Krishna was wise. Krishna was a little smarter than the other people that he has met. So he would turn to Krishna for advice. And what kind of advice? It would be like Arjuna going and telling him, "See, I wish to do this. Krishna, you tell me, is it a good idea? Is it a good thing to do this?" And in the same manner, they come to Krishna and say that, "Krishna, we want to reclaim our kingdom. Krishna, we want to avenge what has happened to Draupadi. You tell us what to do." So Krishna was guiding them based on what they wanted to do, right? Many of us, I think, do the same with Swami also, isn't it? We know what we want. We only turn to Swami asking him to enable us to achieve what we have already wanted. Because somewhere we definitely have that wisdom that Swami knows better, Swami is wiser than me. If not believing that Swami is God, we at least know that Swami is wiser than us. But even in this, we are only giving Swami very limited access to our life. But it is when we surrender to Swami that we are offering unconditional access to our life to Swami. They speak of this as being three levels of respect that we have in our relationship with a guru or with God. It's called Pātha, Nipātha, and Pranipātha. Pātha is when one person has respect. He's a bit detached. He's not, when you come in contact with a godly person, when you come in contact with a noble person, if you meet some Swamijis, he's not your guru. He's not your spiritual master, but that doesn't mean that you don't respect that person. You will give that person the respect that is due to that person, right? That is the lowest level where it's called Pātha, that you give respect to the other person and but still there is a certain amount of distance. Nipātha, the second stage, is when that respect begins to turn into reverence, right? You give more value to that person's words. In the case of Swami, you start giving more value to what Swami says. There is more obedience, there is more acceptance of what Swami chooses. But still, this is only a second state where we make our choices. We go to Swami and we say, "Swami, this is what I want to do. This is what the career I want to take." And then if Swami says, "No, this is not good for you, you do something else," we'll say, "Okay, Swami, we'll take your advice," in that sense. But the highest is Pranipata, or complete surrender. You don't come to Swami to take Swami's help or take Swami's advice to achieve the goals that you have set for yourself, but you come to Swami and say, "Swami, I am yours. You guide me to the goal that you choose through the path that you choose for me." So we all come to Swami as students, as employees, as pilgrims, as householders with troubles, bachelors with ambitions, maybe elderly people in search of peaceful retirement, and add any number of things to that list. But Swami will never force one thing upon us, and that is pranipata or surrender. That step each one of us will have to take. That step, and that is a sign of highest wisdom when we come to Swami and say that, you know, I've tried everything, Swami. I've lost hope in my knowledge. I've lost hope in my understanding. I submit to you. You tell me what to do. You take care completely. My life is yours, right? And that is the state which Swami will never force upon any devotee. That has to come from the devotee himself or herself, right? And in this point, Arjuna has finally made that choice. He says, Tvam Prapannam. He says, I surrender. And in the cosmic play, the whole drama is played for this one moment when you question all that you've gathered, question all that you've learned and all that you've understood, and you understand that there's something fundamentally mistaken in your approach to life itself. And that is the point Arjuna is in. And when the individual soul or the jivi goes through this lifetimes through the morass of worldly existence, it finally comes in contact with a person who can give that wisdom, a guru, a master, an avatar. In this case, Krishna has come in contact with Arjuna. And Arjuna, when we're talking, it's not only Arjuna the individual, but that soul has traveled many, many lifetimes to come to this point. In the Kurukshetra battle, he's standing there and he says, all my learning has failed me, all my wisdom has failed me. That's what Arjuna says, everything has failed me. And at the same time, he is having the contact of Lord Krishna himself, Bhagwan himself. And at that point, finally, even coming to contact with the avatar does not force surrender on the individual jivi. He waits. He waits for that to come from the devotee. And finally here, Arjuna is saying, Tvam Prapannam, I have surrendered to you. Accept me as your Sishya. You tell me what to do. Right? So when an individual soul has traveled many, many lifetimes, finally it comes to this point where it seeks the guidance. And as Swami was saying, you know, Arjuna admits that his perspective is wrong. Arjuna admits that all his learning has failed him. In a sense, he's emptying himself and he's saying, you fill me with what is right according to you, right? And finally he's saying, I don't want the mundane, I want the supreme. I don't want success, I want wisdom. I don't want prayers, I don't want prayers, which is what we refer to as the worldly welfare. I want shreyas, which is the supreme welfare. And then the individual becomes a sishya. Oftentimes I give this analogy, you know, when we were studying in our 12th standard. In India, the school leaving exam, which is the 12th exam, is supposed to be one of the most important events in your life till that point. It's supposed to be a life-changing event and you have to do all that you can to get good scores in that 12th standard exams. So apart from the classes we attend in our school, most of the people would land up in some kind of a coaching center. And I recall near my house there was this coaching center and he had a very good name. Anybody going to his classes would definitely do better in the exams, right? And this person would have three kinds of packages which he would offer. One package is that just a month before the exams would typically be in March or something. So in the month of February, in the month of late January, you would go to him and sign up for this particular program where all that he will do is he will keep giving you mock tests. He will keep giving you questionnaires which you will have to answer, which are very similar to the exam that you will be facing on the final day. So he would do nothing but keep giving you tests, and there would be tests like they would start by giving chapter-wise tests, and then eventually the entire syllabus would be covered, and you'll be doing mock tests of your final exam in that sense. He will never teach. He will only keep giving you exams. And in the process of writing so many tests, you will figure out what is to be studied. You will figure out where you're weak and you will do better. And eventually, if you are a person who would have landed up with 70%, you can be sure that by taking those tests, you'll be getting something like an 80%. That was one package that he had. The other package that he would have is you could join about 3 months before the exam. That is, you would have learnt all your concepts. By December, you would have been taught everything in school. And you come to him for the nuances, you know, how to write or how to study in a manner that you can remember the concepts and how to, you know, some of these tips which are very important to ace in the exam. So if you wish, you can go and join that for 3 months. And obviously, the prices would vary according to which package that you choose. The final package is, or the main package which you would have is, you go and sign up to his classes very well in advance, maybe even when you're studying your 11th standard. For the 12th standard exam, you would sign up for a class in your 11th standard itself. And if you do that, he will ensure that he will teach you, even as you are learning whatever you're learning in your classes, in your school, he will teach the same things with focused attention for you. He will teach you some of the concepts which may not be elaborated in your class, and he will help you understand the concept in a very wholesome manner. So by the end of it, you would not only do very well in the exam, but you would have a very fine idea of the subject itself. Very similarly, I think God offers that option to all of us. Most of us choose that final package, or, you know, the very, very concise package which is there, which is, we will go to our school, we will learn whatever we have to learn, we will finish all of that, and just before the exam, we will come for this final, you know, boost, which will help us. Most of us turn to God like that. We have done all our homework, we have done all our learning, we know what we want, we know what we have chosen. We only come to God literally for him to judge us and reward us, right? That's what it means by taking that mock test. Swami, we have done everything. You tell me what is right, what is wrong, and you reward me for my merits, and you can punish me for my sins. Most of us turn to Swami like that, as the final refuge, as the final boost that we want. Some of us might come a little earlier, that even as we learn, we also want to change the way we look at things based on what Swami is saying. We come and we say, Swami, I want to do this. But if Swami says, no, don't do it like this, do it like that, we will accept it. That is like being in the second package, and that's exactly where even Arjuna is. Arjuna has accepted Krishna as a guide, as an advisor, whose words he will take into consideration. But still, he is holding on to his ideas of what is right and what is wrong and how life has to be led. And finally, he comes to Krishna and tells me, you guide me. At this point is when Arjuna is coming to that state of surrender, and that state of surrender is when you go to God and you say, Swami, you tell me how life has to be led. You teach me what is the purpose of life. You teach me how I should look at worldly life, how I should look at corporate life, how I should look at my work life, how I should be a student. Everything you teach me, right? And that is why this moment when an individual turns to God and says, I want to surrender to you, that is a very, very important moment. And I think in the Bhagavata Vahini, Swami says this: the Lord is more keen that a devotee should turn to the Lord than the devotee himself. We all know that we pine for Swami. We all know that we wish that Swami comes and gives us darshan, and, you know, Swami gives us some kind of communion. But Swami goes on to say that the Lord is more keen that the devotee should seek that than the devotee is keen to have the Lord's communion. And that is why Krishna smiles here, because finally, Arjuna, you have gone through all of these ups and downs, and finally you have come to a point where you are telling, I surrender. Right? And Swami would say this, that Krishna and Arjuna knew each other for a very long time. The story goes that the first time Krishna meets Arjuna is during the marriage between Draupadi and the Pandavas. And from then to this point, Krishna knew Arjuna for a very, very long time. But Swami says, but till now, Krishna never spoke Vedanta to Arjuna. They would speak all kinds of things, but he would never speak Vedanta to Arjuna. It's only now that he speaks Vedanta, because Arjuna says, I am emptying myself of all that I believe is right and wrong. I submit to you. You tell me what is right and wrong, right? And whatever Krishna is going to say from now onwards, it is important for us to keep in mind that it is out of his love and it is out of true compassion. Krishna may sound harsh and apathetic, but all that he is saying is going to be coming out of Krishna's love and love alone. After this program, the Vahini Satsang will come and they are discussing the Prema Vahini in that. The reason why they've taken up Prema Vahini is because that is the first Vahini that Swami wrote. So the first time when Swami wrote a book in 1958 when he started Sanatan Sarathi, Swami said, I'm going to call it Prema Vahini. And I still recall the first time when I read the first few chapters of Prema Vahini, I thought this is going to be a work which is going to speak about love and bhakti and devotion, but that was not the case. The first few chapters, as those of you who follow the Vahini Satsang will know, are purely about morality in society and character and things like that. But why did Swami call it Prema Vahini? Swami was sending this very message that whatever advice he gives, whatever instruction that he gives, whatever discourse that he gives, whatever book he writes, it is nothing but a flow of his love. And that is why Swami named it Prema Vahini. It is not because the book is going to speak only about Prema, but whatever that book speaks, it is coming out of his Prema. And that is why it is Prema Vahini. And similarly, please keep in mind that whatever Krishna is going to speak now, it is coming out of his love. Not only his love for Arjuna, but his love for the entire humanity. And the surrender of Arjuna is very, very important to keep in mind. And this has not come from weakness, right? That is why the context of the entire first chapter is very important. It has not come from physical weakness or lack of self-confidence. This has not come about from selfishness. Yes, egotism was there, but the surrender itself has not come out of egotism. Right? I mean, the surrender itself is not egotistic. It has come out of egotism, but it is not egotistic in itself. And to a person who has surrendered thus, Krishna is going to give the advice which is going to follow. Once, I think in Trai Vrindavan, Swami asked this question to a student, and it actually caught everybody off guard. Swami looked at the students and Swami said, hey, boy, if I ask you to do something that is wrong, will you do it? Swami asked, if Swami tells you to do something that is wrong, will you do it? And this was a small boy who looked at Swami and said, yes, Swami, whatever Swami says, I will do. And for a moment, we all thought that that's probably the right answer to give, right? That's the kind of obedience that we should have to a guru. But then Swami wanted to drive something which was more profound, more subtle. Swami said, no, wrong answer. And Swami went on to explain. He said, you should say, Swami can never tell me to do anything that is wrong. You should have that confidence. You should have told that as the answer. What is the difference between what that boy said and what Swami was expecting? See, Swami asked, if I tell you to do something wrong, which means you have already qualified it as wrong. And because Swami is saying, you will do it. But what Swami was saying is, surrender is not just in obedience, but surrender is in thought itself. The feeling that the moment anything comes from Swami, any instruction comes from Swami, it can be nothing but right, it can be nothing but good. Whatever Swami says can never be wrong. I hope I'm explaining it well. The subtle difference, Swami is saying that if you say that whatever Swami, even if it is wrong, I will do, it is telling Swami that it is wrong, but I will do it because you're telling. But what Swami was saying is we should have the confidence that if it comes from Swami, it cannot be wrong. It is always right. Right? And that is the surrender that we have to keep in mind. And why is this understanding of surrender important at this very point where we're talking about this? The next few verses are very, very powerful and profound verses. I can describe them as very, very sharp knives. And as Swami would say, a knife can be used by a thief to take lives. A knife can be used by a surgeon to save lives. And these ideas which Krishna is going to speak in the second chapter following the verse which is going to come can be contorted and spoken of as verses which suggest violence or which support violence. These can be misused in that manner. And those who wish to show the Bhagavad Gita itself as a text that promotes violence can always pick these verses and say that look at what Krishna is saying. He's telling that you can go and kill anybody, it doesn't matter. Right? That is why the context of the Gita is so very important. It is for a person like Arjuna that this advice is being given. And Arjuna is dharmic, he is righteous, he is also compassionate. He is not weak, but he has surrendered. When you take a sharpened knife and you hand it to a doctor who is compassionate and who is also very good at his skill, you can be sure that the surgery is going to be successful, right? And that is what Krishna is doing. He is taking a sharpened knife and he is giving it to a worthy person to wield that knife. A thief might use the knife to take lives, but the person who has made the knife sharp is not responsible for what the thief is doing, right? And that is why these verses which are being given are the highest of philosophies. They can be misused if the person who is using them is himself or herself contorted, but the philosophy is supreme nevertheless. And the other context that has to be always kept in mind as we go through these verses is that the other verse which was repeated in that other phrase which was repeated in the verse that we just heard, that is senayor ubhayor madhye, in the battlefield between the two armies. That is the context. The whole discussion is happening in the battlefield just before a war is about to begin. The war, the bloodshed, the killing, the warriors, all of this form the context of what Krishna is explaining in the next few verses, right? And when Krishna explains about death, we must remember that this is the context of the Gita. The message is universal nevertheless. Whatever he is going to explain, as I said, is the highest philosophy and it is going to be useful to all of us. But the context is the battle, the battlefield, and Arjuna the warrior. I know that this has been a very, very long description for a single verse, but this is not the description only for the verse that we just heard. This is the placing in context what are the verses which are going to follow, because I'm doing this because this is what sometimes confuses me. Why would Krishna say this, justifying killing? Why would Krishna give these verses, justifying the death of people and somebody dying in scores? But we should always keep in mind that Krishna is giving a sharpened knife to a person who is good, who will not harm anybody, and who has absolute skill, right? He's very skillful in what he does. He's a warrior, and he is a chief among warriors, and Krishna is giving it to him. And more importantly, he is a person who has surrendered to Krishna, and he says, Krishna, you tell me what is right and wrong, I will do it. So if we were to take whatever Krishna is going to tell from here onwards, what is important is that idea of surrender, right? Our minds should be empty, and there is no point in looking at the Bhagavad Gita, reading it and saying, oh, it's such a phenomenal work. It is like telling Swami, Swami, your discourse was so good. Swami will say, so what? What did it mean to you? That is what is important. So the Bhagavad Gita being profound is not important. The Bhagavad Gita being a scholarly work is not important. But for the Bhagavad Gita to matter to you and me, that state in which Arjuna is, he has signed up for the class, as I said, the long-term class. And that is what we have to sign up to. We have to go and tell Swami, Swami, I don't know what is right and wrong. I don't know the way to the destination. I don't know how to live my life. I turn to you for guidance. You accept me as yours and you guide me. With that attitude in our mind, let us pray to Swami, Shishyasteham Shadhimam Twam Prapannam. Shishyasteham Shadhimam Twam Prapannam. With that attitude of surrender, let us now listen to the next few verses. I think we might have time for a couple of them. What follows are very, very powerful verses which can be used at any point when we are sorrowful, just like how Arjuna is. What comes next is the 11th verse of the second chapter.
Shri Bhagavanuvacha Ashochyananvashochastvam Prajnyavadamscha Bhashase Gatasuna Gatasumscha Nanushochanti Panditaha.
Lord Krishna said, Why grieve for those whom no grief is due, and yet profess wisdom? The wise grieve neither for the dead nor the living. As I mentioned, Arjuna has accepted that he is not able to know right from wrong, that his knowledge has failed him. But nevertheless, he himself gave a discourse, the entire first chapter, in the second half of the first chapter maybe, and the first few verses of the second chapter. So he spoke like a scholar himself. He gave this wonderful discourse and we said how scholarly his understanding of dharma was. And we did see that it was quite a show of scholarship. So Krishna first wishes to establish that whatever Arjuna is speaking now is nothing but bunkum. He says that this is all not right understanding. And he wants to establish that what you've been saying and what you've been doing has got no correlation at all. And that's why he says, Ashochyana anvashochastvam. Shochana is grief. Shochana is to worry about something. Shochyana means that which is worthy of grief, that which can be worried about. Ashochyana then means that which should not be worried about, that which is not worthy to be worried about. So Krishna is telling Arjuna, Ashochyana anvashochahatvam. You are grieving for that which should not be grieved for. And then, Prajnana vadamscha bhashase. You are grieving for those who should not be grieved, and after that you speak words of wisdom. He says there is no correlation between what you speak and the state of sadness that you are in. Prajna vadaha means words of wisdom, wise words. Krishna is saying you are speaking wise words. Let me tell you what is true wisdom. Prajna means wisdom and vadaha means arguments or words. So Krishna is going to tell you are talking about wise words. I will tell you what is real wisdom. And Krishna is going to explain to Arjuna what is true prajna. And eventually he's going to describe to Arjuna the person who is constantly in that state of wisdom, what we refer to as a sthita prajna, one who is constantly in that state of prajna. So firstly, Krishna is rebuking Arjuna. He says, you speak wise words on one hand, but your actions are not wise. Why are they not wise? You grieve for something that is not worthy of grief. Ashochyana. When we live in society, there's a certain decorum that we maintain, right? There are some events where we are supposed to be happy, and there are some events where we are expected to be a little gloomy. He always say this, you know, the tradition of inviting huge guests to the marriages. When you go to a marriage, you're supposed to be happy, right? And that's when you're going to bless the couple who are going to go into this long journey of companionship with all your heart. That is the whole idea. When you go to a marriage, you're supposed to be happy and you're supposed to wish them with all your happiness. And one of the things they do that is they feed you really well, because when you're well fed, you automatically are happy. Swami would often say this. When you're well fed, you come to a good mood, right? So that is the whole idea of inviting so many guests at a marriage, 500,000 people, give them very, very good food. And then when they come to the stage and they wish the couple, they really wholeheartedly, at least full stomach, they come and wish the couple, which is very, very important. Blessings of as many people as we can get is important for occasions like that. But of course, now what we do is we do the wedding in such a grand manner with the idea that everybody should be jealous of the arrangements that we have done. The wedding should be so grand that people should feel jealous. Oh, my wedding was not like this. Oh, my child's wedding was not like this. The food here is so much more grander. But the whole idea is to make people happy, and that is one tradition that we have to keep in mind. That's a different thing altogether. But the point I'm trying to make is, when we live in society, we have this clear understanding where, what are the events or what are the circumstances where we are supposed to be happy. We are supposed to go in those events and be happy. Marriage is a situation where we are supposed to be happy. When you go to a funeral, we cannot laugh and have a gala time there. You're supposed to be a little sober there, right? So in society, we understand that there are some occasions where you have to be happy. Some occasions, you have to be a little mellow. There's a very beautiful discourse which Swami is giving to students in Kodaikanal. It's not like a discourse. Swami is sitting and just talking to them. And Swami was explaining this thing that he says, let's see, when you're sitting and eating food, and somebody is sitting next to you, and let's say that you're having an upstuck stomach, you should not be talking to the other person about the problem that you have in your stomach when that person is eating food. You should be aware of what is the situation you are in. Swami very, very graphically explains that. You know, some people have no sense of propriety. They go and tell, you know, when you're eating food, they'll come and say, I don't want food. Naku vomit ostundi. Swami is saying in that. You should know where to speak what. Similarly, when we live in society as a mature person, as a cultured person, we should know where we are meant to laugh, where we can smile, where we are supposed to be gloomy, right? So there are situations where you're allowed to be happy, or it is right to be happy. There are situations where you're expected to be sad. So a mature, cultured person will know which are the events or circumstances that are ashochyana. One must not be sad, and which are the events which are shochyana. It is right to be sad in those events or circumstances. But as you become more and more mature, as you become more and more wise, Swami says that you will act according to the situation, but not necessarily be sad in that same way. When you're going to a funeral, you know that this is how the behavior has to be. It does not mean that you're going to become sad and gloomy yourself, right? So as you grow mature, you will behave in a manner that is appropriate to the situation, but internally you will find lesser and lesser reasons to be elated about anything and depressed about anything. That is the sign of maturity, right? See, when we were kids, we would cry for all kinds of petty things. If we were to make a list of things that we would cry for when we were children, we would find that they are very, very petty things. And today we will not cry for any of them, right? Of course, today we have bigger toys to cry about. We cry about a house, we cry about a car. But when we were kids, we cried about such petty things. The reason why that is suitable for that age is that immaturity is acceptable there. As we become mature, we will find lesser and lesser reasons to be elated as well as be depressed, right? And that is why Krishna is saying, O Arjuna, you speak wise words, but you act so unwisely by grieving for things that are not meant to be grieved. And then Krishna says, who is really a pandita, a wise one, a knowledgeable one? He says, gathasun. Gathasun means those whose life is gone. Agathasun means those whose life is still there. So he says, gathasun, agathasun cha. Those who are alive and those who are dead. Na anushochanti panditaha. The really knowledgeable ones will not grieve for those who are alive, will not grieve for those who are dead. Of course, I hope none of us here are going to be grieving for somebody being alive, but he says that a pandita is one who does not grieve even for a person who is dead. But just now I was telling you that there are some situations where you're allowed to be sad, and I said a funeral is a situation where you're supposed to be sad. And Arjuna is on the brink of what probably could be described as a funeral mela, because Arjuna is Parantapa. He is the one who is going to be the scorcher of the enemies. So if he is going to fight this battle, there's going to be a huge list of funerals which are going to happen. He is on the brink of a funeral, and that is why he's sad. So it seems like his sadness is justified. But in this chapter, as we go forward, Krishna will explain why it is not worthwhile even to grieve over death, which seems to be such a legitimate reason to be sad about. And as I mentioned, Arjuna is a sugnani, right? He's a mature person, he's a cultured person, he knows where to be sad, he knows where to be happy, he knows all of these modalities of social life. But Krishna is going to take him from sugnana to prajnana, right? That's why he says, prajnana vadaha, you speak words of wisdom, I will teach you what is true prajnana. And that is what Krishna is going to do in this chapter and the rest of the chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. I think we'll have time for one more verse, so we'll do that, the verse number 12 of chapter 2.
Natvebaham jatu nasam natvanne me janadhipa nachaivana bhavishyamaha sarve vayamatah param.
Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So why do we grieve over death? When we said that it is all right to be sad and gloomy in a funeral, why do we really feel sad when somebody dies? It's because someone ceases to exist, right? That person was living, that person was in front of your eyes, he was there, she was there, and suddenly they cease to exist. They were with us for a period of time, and now they are no more, right? That's the word we use, so-and-so is no more. So we had their company for a while, we enjoy their company for a while, we love them when we had them around. When it is taken away from us, when their presence, their company is snatched away from us, then we feel sad, right? But consider this, all of us would have some people, some friends, relatives, uncles, aunties, cousins, maybe even our own children, who are living in a different country. And some relative or a very good friend, let's imagine that he's living in a different country. We would not have seen that person for many, many years, which means we have not had their company for a very long time. But we don't necessarily grieve about not having their company. We don't grieve about not being able to see that person. So even though I don't see that person, even though I don't have the pleasure of his or her company, or I'm not able to speak to that person so often, the knowledge that that person exists is enough for me not to grieve, isn't it? Yes, we may miss that person and feel sad that that person is not around us. That's a different thing. But that sadness cannot be equated to the grief that we would feel when we know that that person has died, right? So even though I don't see that person, even though I don't have the pleasure of that person's company, I don't grieve because I believe that that person continues to exist somewhere. And here in the battlefield, it's a question of life and death. As I said, the context is the battlefield. So Arjuna's grief is definitely about the people dying, and Krishna is going to explain about death. He says, before we come to the explanation of Krishna, there's a subtlety over here which we have to keep in mind. Yes, Arjuna is crying about the death that is going to happen, right? His grief is about the person who are going to die in the process. But Arjuna is not exactly crying that these people are going to die, because Arjuna is wise enough to know that death is definitely inevitable, right? As Swami would say, Bhishma, when he was fighting the battle, was 115 years old. And certainly Arjuna is clearly not going to cry for somebody who is anyway going to kick the bucket in a few years, right? 115 years is a very long time. So Arjuna is not necessarily crying over death. And if you look at Arjuna, he lost his father when he was a teenager, right? Pandu dies in the forest when Arjuna is a small boy. So he has definitely seen death. He has definitely seen loss. He's not worried so much about death, especially about a 115-year-old person dying. You know, at some age when you die, actually, it's seen as a blessing. He said, yeah, you've lived a full life. It's a good time to go, right? So Arjuna is not purely crying over death alone. Arjuna is crying over death. And more than that, he's crying that he is going to be the cause of death, right? Those are the two things that he's crying about. But nevertheless, the event is also there. The fact that he is going to be the causer of that event is also there. So Krishna in this chapter is going to deal with both of these things. The event itself, which is death, and your role in causing that event. The doership as well as the act which is being done. Both of these are going to be dealt with in this chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And in a way, this defines the concept of Sankhya Yoga itself. I think maybe I'll give a brief description about that and we can conclude with that. The whole point is about, as I said, there is a choice between him. Arjuna can fight, cannot fight, or he wins and rules, or he loses and goes back to the forest or whatever it is. And Arjuna was asking about the other option. What if I run away from such choice making altogether? Right? Because he says that today if I go away, Duryodhana is not going to be quiet. Duryodhana is going to send people after him. So he's got to be constantly making this choice. So he's talking about sannyasa. The moment Arjuna takes sannyasa, he's going to say that I'm never coming back to become a king in this place. So which means he is completely getting away from making any of those choices. So first of all, Arjuna is talking about sannyasa. A sannyasi wishes to go away because he wants to go away because he's not able to make a choice. But why does a sannyasi really go away? Why does a sannyasi really give up all of these attachments? Swami would say a sannyasi does that because he knows the truth that no one belongs to anyone, that the body is ephemeral, the body is not real, right? A true sannyasi, Swami gives the example of somebody like Sukha Maharishi. Sukha Maharishi takes sannyasa even as he is born because he knows that there is no point in living in this society, no point in saying that so-and-so is my mother, so-and-so is my father, I need to earn my living. So Sukha Maharishi is somebody who is born and he goes off into sannyasa. Why? Because he knows these truths. So what is Krishna telling here is very, very important. He says, you speak words of wisdom, but you are actually not acting those words of wisdom, right? And that is why what Krishna explains in this is when you say Sankhya is a philosophy, right? Sankhya is a philosophy which was given by the sage Kapila. The philosophy of Sankhya is that there are two very important things that come from Sankhya philosophy. One is it looks at and studies deeply what creation is all about. What we refer to as prakriti, what we refer to as our body, the individual atma, all of that is studied in Sankhya in a very, very deep manner, right? That is the philosophy of Sankhya. But when we say Sankhya yoga, the yoga becomes the path. When we say Sankhya yoga, it is the path which will lead to that understanding. And interestingly, another very important concept that comes from Sankhya yoga is what we refer to as the three gunas. When the rishis look at the world and try to understand its nature, they come up with this understanding of the three gunas. And from the three gunas, the nature that each guna stands for, comes all of the ethical understandings and morality that we speak about in Dharma Shastras, right? So Sankhya is not only a philosophy that speaks about the ultimate nature of life and death itself, but it is also a philosophy that speaks about, now knowing that this is the final concept, how am I supposed to lead my life, right? So now Arjuna is saying that I'll take sannyasa, but Krishna is saying that you're saying that you'll take sannyasa, but you don't understand the eventual concepts which define the idea of sannyasa. So Krishna is going to define what that ultimate philosophy is, and he's also going to teach how that philosophy can be reached by leading a life, walking on a path which will lead to that. And that's why this particular chapter is referred to as Sankhya Yoga. Coming back to this particular verse, but for now Krishna is saying, why cry? No one is going anywhere. And Krishna says, there was no such time when I did not exist, or no such time when you did not exist, nor a time when any of these kings were standing in front of you, any of these warriors were standing in front of you, did not exist. Similarly, there is never going to be a time when any of us will cease to exist. Yes, they won't necessarily continue to exist in the form of Krishna, Arjuna, Bhishma, Drona, but they will exist nevertheless. Yes, there will be a change, but why should you worry about change? That is the import of this particular verse. But why is this change being spoken of as being so ordinary, right? Because for us, this is the biggest change. Death is the biggest change that we face in our life. But Krishna is speaking of it as another change. And that he will explain in the verses to come. But for now, it's time for me to wrap up the show. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. We completed with the verse 12 of chapter 2. I know we've taken very, very few verses in this particular chapter, but to understand the context of the Bhagavad Gita and the philosophy which is being spoken now is very, very important. I felt it was very important for me to reiterate that for myself, and I thought it would be useful to do it. with all of you, and I hope it was useful to all of you. You can always send me feedback as to what you thought about what I said. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'll join you all again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the Vahini Satsang. I join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. Happy listening.
Listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.